All right, guys, we're good. Luke is back. Everything is back to normal for now. And we've got a couple of streaming drops. I did see one movie in theaters this weekend, but this was primarily a streaming weekend. And oh, what a streaming weekend it was, Luke. We've got, with again, two things that could not be more for you and me if we tried. We have the remake of Roadhouse from Doug Liman and starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. And we've got the first TV series adaptation from David Benioff and D.B. Weiss since the disastrous last season of Game of Thrones, The Three-Body Problem, which is officially dropped on Netflix. We're going to be reviewing both of those today. And then afterwards, I'm going to talk about a little neon movie that I saw in theaters this past weekend starring the one and only Sydney Sweeney called Immaculate, which, oh boy, that movie gives most conventional horror endings a run for its money. I will just say that. Luke, it's good to have you back, man. You got anything to say before we get started?
No, only that I saw 4 streaming releases this week. We're going to talk about 2 of them. Maybe we can mention the other 2 briefly.
Most definitely.
It was a good weekend for streaming.
Yeah, it was a very good weekend for streaming. All of that and more on today's episode of the Talk TV Podcast. Stay tuned. You know, Luke, it's funny, as I look forward into the rest of 2024, after the first 2 months, really kind of what the precedent I feel like has been set for this year is you'll get like one weekend of every month where you get like one blockbuster that demolishes everything, at least until the summer. And then what that leaves is you leave the next couple of weekends that are open for some pretty interesting drops, whether that be indie movies, whether that be streaming releases, what have you, you know, because if you look at it really, the only 2 major blockbusters that came, I mean, obviously, yeah, March had Ghostbusters, but and Kung Fu Panda got completely overridden. Like, Dune, pretty much as we knew, once it got moved to March, you know, out of the rather crowded last November, which, if you ask me, everything from last November suffered as a result of Dune getting moved out of it. Pretty much everything that came out in between Dune 2 and Godzilla vs. Kong either flopped or was an indie or a streaming release. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, considering that, you know, a majority of the movies that we end up loving and a majority of the surprises that we get out of each year are usually streaming or indie related. But Roadhouse is an interesting one because you've got, so this is an idea that they've been trying to bounce around for quite a while now, right? The 80s one is this iconic cult hit movie. You know, it's Patrick Swayze with a mullet. It's a classic 80s formula where Drifter comes into town, cleans it up with his no-nonsense style, and he may have a dangerous background, but you know that at the end of the day, he's going to get the job done and deal with the evil bad guys who are probably a little bit too cartoonishly evil for their own good, but it was the 80s, and everybody was on coke, so nobody cared. But, so this is an idea, like I said, that they've been bouncing around for a while now. They were originally going to do a spinoff slash prequel of it, I'm not sure, with Ronda Rousey back in or circa 2015, 2016, when she was set to be in the Fast and Furious, right after she'd been in the Fast and Furious movies, right when she was blown up. And then she lost that fight, and then pretty much every single idea that they pitched her way kind of just went away. So now here we are. You have this remake, right? You've got Jake Gyllenhaal starring. You've got Doug Liman directing. This is his first movie since, I believe, 2021's Chaos Walking, which was another failed attempt at a YA dystopian franchise well after that phase had kind of already passed us by. And I remember they were making a big deal about, you know, they wanted this to go to theaters, but Amazon, for whatever reason, was like, nah, this one's going directly to streaming. And I remember Liman and Gyllenhaal were very, very mad at that. And now after having finally watched it, I have to say I did enjoy it a lot more than I thought I was going to, this being only 2 days after I'd watched the original Roadhouse. But I will say I don't necessarily know. I guess kind of where I'm torn as far as where to start off this conversation is I don't necessarily know if this should have gone to theaters or if it belonged on streaming. So I guess I just wanted your thoughts on that before we got this started.
No, because when the trailer came out, I was like, oh, this feels like a theater kind of movie. But then I watched it. I'm like, yeah, I see it. The same way when I felt the same when Prey came out. I'm like, well, this is a Predator movie. Why aren't we seeing this in theaters? I'm watching it like, Yeah, it just has that sort of minuscule feel to it. Of course, Prey was very good, but it wasn't a theater type movie, and I would say neither was this. I said my one sentence Letterboxd review, it has the streaming quality CGI at times, so it's like, yeah, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, it's so interesting because obviously, again, the idea, it's so weird to me where you have an entire generation of kids that have grown up only understanding that, you know, certain movies are going to go to theaters versus certain movies are going to be streaming. Then you have others who, you know, just don't go to the movies anymore since COVID. They just only watch things during streaming, you know, when they're streaming. And that's still so weird for me to wrap my head around because, again, for the bulk majority of my life, like, it's still only recently, it's only been about the last, like, 10, just about 15 years that I'm still getting used to that whole idea because I'm still used to the idea of everything going to theaters and then everything eventually, you know, becoming available to watch. So it's still so weird for me to wrap my head around this whole idea of certain things only going to theaters versus certain things going to streaming because there are points where I could see this as a theatrical release and I could see this having done real well. But at the same time, it's like, but just for the ease of access and the fact that this already kind of stood out above the rest of the streaming releases. Because what's the biggest problem that streaming releases always have, right? Standing out, right? Because they don't have that sort of urgency, you know, that theatrical releases do. You know, you have to watch this when it comes out or else you're going to miss out on the hype, right? Because streaming doesn't have that and it's quite frankly never had that. Maybe a little bit during COVID, but definitely not now.
I'd say unless it's like a big release, like a Knives Out, like right. that was a huge movie that released in theaters, and now it's going to be on Netflix. Like
exactly,
yeah,
exactly. But I guess my point is that like Roadhouse already had enough of a reputation to it, so at the very least, it was going to be able to stand out, which is good. Now, as far as the movie itself, so Doug Liman. Well, I guess before we get into Doug Liman, have you seen the original Roadhouse?
I have not. I wasn't really feeling like it. It's like I'll just watch Roadhouse for the pod.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't think I was going to, but it was a couple things. One, the Rewatchables had just released their episode on Roadhouse, so I'm like, all right, you know, because that's my rule. Whatever I only ever listen to a Rewatchables episode if I've seen the movie, and you know, if they'll release a movie, then I'm like, okay, this is gonna tie in. All right. Plus, I know this is like an '80s cult hit. You know, one of my dad's favorite movies growing up. My dad's seen. Every single one of these movies when they came out in theater. So I'm like, all right, I'll watch it for him, you know. And I will say I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. I'm very, very hit or miss when it comes to 80s movies. There's usually never really any down the middle for me. I either love it or I think it's crap, especially when it comes to the action movies, right? Obviously, you know, I tend to think that a majority of the Stallone and Schwarzenegger movies are really good. I try to avoid the Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme movies as much as I can, as entertainingly bad as I've heard those movies are. But Roadhouse was one where, it was one of those things where the reputation had kind of surpassed the movie itself, like a lot of the movie, a lot of the like 80s feeling movies at that time. And I can definitely say that it is very similar to Rocky IV. It's like an embodiment of the 80s as a culture, you know, with the big hair. And just the crazy antics and the fact that a majority of this movie feels like it really doesn't have a plot. It feels like they just had a location and they're like, and they had a couple of stars and they're like, all right, we're just going to have as many fights in this movie as humanly possible. And
it's kind of like this movie. I will say.
Kind of, but in a weird way, like again, the biggest difference between that movie and this movie is that movie was a complete result of cocaine and music video style shooting. This movie is much more so a result of them essentially trying to do. It's so weird to me how trends repeat because you always see this happen where you have like, you know, the different styles and sensibilities, you know, about every 20 years or so they repeat and they come back. But like with different new sensibilities and technology, it was interesting to me how this movie still had a lot of the plot trappings of the original while still having like a modern day sensibility. Like this doesn't feel like a movie that would take place necessarily in 2024. If not for, you know, the way it's shot and the stars and the location, everything. Like, obviously, like, yeah, aesthetics-wise, it looks like a movie that was shot in 2024. But vibe-wise, it really doesn't. This movie kind of feels like it takes place out of time, out of place in a weird way. Like, the Jake Gyllenhaal Dalton doesn't feel like a real character.
I had a very similar thought.
Right, it doesn't feel like it almost feels like a fever dream at times, you know? And that's even before we get into Conor McGregor, where it's like half the time these characters are talking, and I'm like, nobody ever talks like this in real life, you know? It's almost like they're doing the whole goofy, self-aware, oh, we know we're a remake, oh, we know we're ripping ourselves off. Like, you've got the girl that he meets when he first gets into town who's doing the commentary on, oh, this is like a Western movie, isn't it? I'm like, okay, like, I get this. But at the same time, there was something oddly charming about it and something oddly compelling about it. And I don't know if that's just how Doug Liman directs it, right? Because because Doug Liman, I think, is the other piece that's very, very important to this. Because if this had been just some other no-name, unknown director that Amazon just tapped in order to direct this property, I would have been like, okay, this definitely would have been a lot worse than it was. But Amazon, I would say, has been, for the most part, pretty good about working with certain filmmakers. And again, they get Doug Liman, who, again, hit or miss director for sure, but his hits, oh my God. I mean, this is the guy who did Swingers, Go, Bourne Identity, which if you ask me is still probably my favorite Bourne movie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, American Made, Edge of Tomorrow, which is a revolutionary 21st century action movie, if not for the fact that it kind of got overshadowed by John Wick, you know? So he's got some misses in there for sure, you know, Jumper, Fair Game, Chaos Walking. There was another one that he did that kind of got, The Wall, I think, was a movie with John Cena and Aaron Taylor Johnson that kind of got overlooked, this because it came out the same year as American Made. So he's got some misses, you know, and like I said, the problem with Doug Liman is he's developed this reputation as this director who takes notoriously long to work on projects because he takes the whole idea of, like, figuring it out as you go along a little bit too far, I would say. There's still the stories about Bourne Identity, where he basically just, like, stopped contact with the studio because the studio was like, yeah, where's our movie? And he's like, yeah, I'm still working on it. And he basically, like, stopped communicating with them. And Matt Damon essentially had to act as a liaison between Liman and the studio as well, because there were, again, because of how long Liman takes to shoot movies, you know, that would create some conflicts with the stars who had, like, you know, other obligations lined up because Matt Damon was doing the Bourne movies and the Ocean's movies at the same time. But I think it really makes a difference here because even though it is action on a budget, specifically an Amazon budget, it still looks cool and it still looks interesting. And, like, again, it is still compelling, even though, again, the script is kind of nonsensical. So I feel like I've talked enough here. I want to know your thoughts on the movie in general.
Yeah, just to mention on the action a bit, I feel like it was too well shot for the type of movie it is. It's just like a bodyguard. No, like a bouncer guy fighting some people, but it's shot like a superhero movie almost at times. Yeah. So that was a bit of a disconnect, but it kind of worked in the end. It's like, okay, these two big muscly boys just hitting each other as hard as they can.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was pretty harmless mostly. It was just like a fun, enjoyable stream release. It started off, I'm like, this isn't that good. But as I settled into it, of course, Jake Gyllenhaal, he's not really doing a whole lot of acting, but he's still Jake Gyllenhaal, and that's going to go a long way in any movie. Like you said, the supporting cast is kind of like your basic template characters. It's like, oh, he meets the girl, she patches him up, whatever, they go on a date, like, oh, this town used to be like this, and then all the bad people came in, but... Yeah, it was enjoyable. And I quite enjoyed Conor McGregor. He's very much just... The director gave him no notes, just like, be yourself.
Yeah.
But it worked in this environment.
Besides, I would love to see what director would dare to be like, try to give Conor McGregor acting notes. Just that's imagining that sequence of events alone in my head is hilarious. But yeah, like I said, this movie's got a lot of stuff that it still has from the original. Like I said, it has the love interest, which pretty much goes like beat for beat, except for the fact that Daniela Melchior in this one is a lot more like opposed to him afterwards before like she kind of warms up to him. They also have this thing where Billy Magnussen is the bad guy. He's like the Ben Gazzara stand-in in this one where like
he's playing his character from No Time to Die. That's
exactly. I mean, Billy Magnussen has kind of like just become known as that guy who's like always like kind of a little bit twitchy and a little bit too snivelly for his own good. But again, what's interesting, right, is you had in the original, right, that this bad guy played by Ben Gazzara, who's just this evil rich asshole who just owns everything and like is like wants to own the roadhouse. But in this one, you have it where Billy Magnussen's character is like the son of some rich, famous crime lord. And they seem to be hinting that it's going to be some famous actor, but it's like, no, they never do. Which is like, oh, my dad's in jail. And it's just like, oh, you hear like one voiceover from him when he calls Conor McGregor's character. And it's like, oh, my son's fucking up. You know, time to get down there and back him up. And then it just, it goes the way that it goes. And you got the Jessica Williams character, who's like the owner of the bar, who again doesn't have a very big part like in the original, but like it's Jessica Williams, so it's like, okay, that's cool. And I will admit, in terms of, you talked about the opening of the movie, opening any movie with Post Malone is a risk in general, but considering the fact that like it was just there to like help establish Dalton as a character. And what I will say is, this movie did give me one thing that I sort of had a problem with from the original, which is in the original, there are vague hints to his backstory, but we never actually get anything other than when Sam Elliott shows up, and Sam Elliott plays sort of like his sidekick slash mentor slash best friend role. And I've got a couple problems with like certain of the ending sequences of it, but the whole thing that's established in the original is that in the original, Dalton is the way he is because he got involved with a married woman without knowing that she was married. And then her husband found out, stuck a gun in his face, and he killed the guy and has been feeling guilty about it ever since. But there's a couple problems with that. Namely, the fact that this is a dude who is used to ripping people's throats out on a daily basis. Second off, the fact that it's an 80s thing where this is an 80s trope that you had happen all the time, which is where characters often felt a lot more guilty about shit that in hindsight really probably wasn't as bad as they made it out to seem. But they needed to do it in order to give the characters some moral gray area. Because let's face it, the 80s were really not that good when it came to being morally gray. It was either good guys good, bad guys bad, and you know there really wasn't any in between. Now we're in the age of the anti-hero, which is where you've got, right, Jake Gyllenhaal's character. And Jake Gyllenhaal, let's just say, you know, this is a guy who has spent the last decade playing some pretty twisted characters. So Gyllenhaal knows how to turn the switches off. And what I liked about his portrayal that I think gave it a little bit of a difference between the last one is the fact that he relatively comes off as, like, always a nice guy. Like, he's always trying to talk his way out of the fights, but not in a way that's, like, condescending or anything. It's always like, you know, I tried to warn you about this, you know, before he, like, kicks the shit out of a couple guys, you know? And the other thing I think that really gives it an edge is the UFC edge. I think that definitely is, adds a lot more context and a lot more interest and moral gray to his character. Where this is a character that, unlike I feel like the Patrick Swayze character, who is for the most part always very calm, very cool, very collected, this is a character who you can tell is just a little bit unhinged. And he even says it. He's like, this is what happens when you push me too far. Like, he is a character, I would say, kind of like the Punisher, where it's like, yeah, he's just one push, one bad day away from just going all out. And I mean, it definitely shows in certain sequences. There's one sequence at the end where he goes and shows up to the one bad guy's place and he kills the one henchman. And just that sequence alone, I was like, okay, now we're cooking with gas here, you know? And I will say that as well, the UFC thing, I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal trained with the UFC for this movie, and it fucking shows, because the fights between Conor McGregor, I don't know how much they were actually choreographing that or if they were just like kind of letting them throw down and turning on the camera. I know Gyllenhaal talked about the fact that McGregor definitely actually punched him for real a couple times, which I'm like, all right, that's obviously, you know, as a person who wants to work in the industry, okay, yeah, probably not so good, but as a viewer, I'm like, oh, that's fucking cool that they can still do this shit, you know? Because man, the fights between them, they were quick. But oh man, were they awesome to watch? Were they awesome to watch?
Like, yeah, they definitely sold the fights. Like, I think if they had to get one thing right, they had to sell that. Yeah, these are real punches, as real as they can be.
So, yes.
Yeah, ooh, that, like, you can even feel the punch through the screen in a way. So I thought that was important. Adding the UFC angle, I think that's interesting because it's something from real life that we can kind of latch onto and associate with Dalton in this one. Although it was like extremely predictable, like what the backstory was to him. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
But it was still, it added an edge to his backstory.
Right. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And the one last thing that I'll have, well, besides the fact that, so right, we talked about the love interest and the fact that the love interest is the daughter of the corrupt cop who's working for Billy Magnuson's character. And I just also thought it was funny where I'm like, oh wow, we have another Fast and Furious connection there. So we have Daniela Melchior, who was in Fast X as Isabel, Dom's unfortunately deceased baby mom's sister. And then you have Joaquin De Almeida as her dad, the corrupt cop.
Yeah, I noticed,
right?
It
was Hernan Reyes, right?
Fast Five.
And I'm like, oh shit, we're putting all the Portuguese people, like the only two well-known Portuguese actors in all of Hollywood, and we're putting them together in a movie. Also, the fact that, and I mean, I didn't want to be the guy to point this out, but the fact that there was a 16-year age gap between Jake Gyllenhaal and Daniela Melchior, I was like, I know that's really not as frowned upon in Hollywood as it is now, but I was just thinking, I'm like, Daniela Melchior is a year older than me. Like, come on, man. I'm just like, really? I'm like, Jake Gyllenhaal's been acting for 20 years. I don't know. That was just the thing that I was thinking about, where it's like, okay, we have a little bit of a Tom Cruise and his much significantly younger love interest in American Maid, who I think there was like a, something like a 21 year age gap or something between the two of them. And and also I think there was something about that in The Mummy too. And I think where Russell Crowe calls Tom Cruise a young man and everyone's like, dude, Tom Cruise is 2 years older than you. What are you doing? So that was just funny. But yeah, the other thing that I wanted to talk about before we jump over to Three Body Problem is the ending, which is where the ending is quite interesting, because that's another thing that's quite different from the original, where the ending in this new, in the original is, you know, he stays in the town, he has a happy ending, he's frolicking with his new love interest in the water. It's a very classic 80s happy ending. And this one, it's like, nah, it's like, I did my thing, I helped save the town, and now I'm leaving. You know, it's like the town's been cleaned up, all the bad guys are gone, they're dead, I'm leaving and moving on to a new town. And it's in a weird way, it almost kind of solves a thing with the original, where the original people were like, oh, why isn't this getting a sequel? And in this one, it's like, no, this kind of does open up the path for more sequels. And I will say that, again, even though this movie, I'm not going to say I love it, I'm not going to say it's one of my favorites of the year. Keep in mind, this is only one of nine movies that I've seen so far for 2024. But I can almost see this, you know, I can almost see this, you know, garnering new sequels, where he's just like bouncing from town to town and cleaning up different town to town after every instance. And I'm
and
like,
it's a different UFC fighter.
Exactly. 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 The possibilities are endless. I would watch more of that. Absolutely. You know, get a new supporting cast, get a new love interest every time. One that, you know, will more than likely
be
younger.
Is this Amazon's
younger.
Bond franchise? Like, I know they own Bond now or whatever.
Yeah, but the problem where they fucked up with Bond is because they underestimated the power of the Broccoli family. And they forgot that, oh, even though they own MGM, Bond is not, a Bond still belongs to the Broccoli family as the producers. Like, they call the shots at the end of that, and they are never letting that go. They are never letting that property go. That is theirs till the end of time. So, but that could be something. I'm just saying that, like, Jake Gyllenhaal has yet to be in like a franchise. So I'm like, if there was ever going to be one, especially one that I would watch, I would say it would be this one.
Yeah, I don't see this becoming exactly a cult hit like maybe the first one did, but it's Amazon. You never know.
It's true.
How many people are going to watch this? We don't know.
Right. It's funny because I look over the Amazon original movies that I've seen over the last couple of years, and they're good, but usually my favorite ones are, like, you know, more of the Oscar ones. You know, like your Manchester by the Seas, your Big Six, you know, You Were Never Really Here's. What's it called? You know, there's a couple that came out in the last couple of years as well. You know, Air, obviously, was really well-beloved. Also, Saltburn. I really like Saltburn, even though that was hit or miss for people. But like I said, they still have yet to really crack their blockbuster formula, mostly because, again, the idea of blockbusters and streaming is still kind of a pretty funny premise. But to say the least, yeah. So with that being said, before we jump over to Three Body Problem, your final thoughts and star rating for Amazon's Roadhouse, starring Jake Gyllenhaal.
My final thoughts. It was a fine weekend watch. I wouldn't overly recommend it to someone, but if you have nothing to watch, then this is fine. I give it a 3 stars. It's better than Argyle, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, to say the least, a lot of movies were better than Argyle. But yeah, I would say, like I said, I woke up on a Saturday morning, I turned it on, I had it on in the background, and then I was, you know, gotten more into it as it went on. We never really talked that much about Conor McGregor, but honestly, we didn't really need to, because that was just somebody who just understood the assignment completely and is just cackling like a mad devil, driving cars into trees, having a ball. The opening scene of this guy is it literally just fucking like jumping off the roof after having banged a guy's wife while the guy was still in the apartment. It's just, it was awesome. I honestly had a blast with this movie. I really, really did. I give this movie 4 stars. So now we jump into the other big streaming release, Three Body Problem. So now this was a much, much anticipated streaming release, to say the least. Like I said, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, right? They had all these projects lined up, which is the reason why they didn't want to do another couple seasons of Game of Thrones. Like, HBO and the fans really wanted them to. You know, they were getting Star Wars offers, and they were getting Netflix offers, and they were getting all these offers. And then the final season of Game of Thrones came and went, and then we had COVID and the strikes just hit through. But the news came out, I believe, sometime either last year or the year before. Benioff and Weiss,
a new
show. It's been a while since they announced this. Probably more than likely actually 2021. So they announced that their next thing is going to be this adaptation of this book trilogy called The Three Body Problem. And naturally, I'm like, okay, it's based off books. I got to start hitting up my book people because I just don't have time to read as much as I would like. I got to start hitting up my book people. Like, what's going on? So I had my friend Patrick from school. and there are a couple other people. And the first thing that you told me was, you're like, okay, this is based off an already completed book series, so this is not going to have the same problems as Game of Thrones. I'm like, thank God. Thank God. Obviously, I'm a little skeptical because it's Netflix, so naturally, knowing that it's Benioff and Weiss are involved, I'm like, it's going to be pretty epically scaled to begin with, because that's just what their stuff is. It's always pretty big and epic in nature. But it's Netflix, so I'm like, okay, Netflix doesn't necessarily usually make things look as good as HBO does, so this could be interesting. And then I don't remember who, but somebody mentioned that it was more sci-fi in nature than fantasy. I'm like, ooh, this could be interesting. So now you read the book, Luke. So walk me through your process of what your thought process was. There it is. When you first heard that this was going to be their next project, you know, your thoughts on the book and everything, their adaptation. What are your thoughts on that leading up to the release of the three body problem? Go.
So I think I got the book sometime last year, but only started reading it and finished it now. I don't know when I heard about them making it, but I remember seeing the first trailer. It was sometime last year. I think it had a release in January, but it got moved or something like that.
But January or February is supposed to, but then it got officially like moved back to March.
Yeah, but so I kind of avoided the trailers because I said, okay, I'm going to read this book. And it's hard sci-fi, which is like, it's very, very based in science. Like The Martian is probably the hardest sci-fi, and Dune is like a very soft sci-fi. And I really like the hard sci-fi stuff. There's a lot of physics talk in here, which is like my one thing that I was missing from the show, that they glossed over a lot of the physics of it. Like there's a full pages of just talking about like how the three bodies interact each other, how people try to solve it over the years. I'm blabbering on, but basically I read it. I thought, this is really cool. There's some really cool visuals that I'd like to see. I know that in China they already made a show of this, but this is of course the westernized version. And you can tell because not everybody's Chinese like they are in the book.
Yes, and that was a thing that I heard that a couple people had a problem with. Because they're like, yeah, they Americanized a couple of Chinese characters. So how is this going to be as good? Especially because, you know, people have been complaining about whitewashing for years. So that was going to lead to my second question, right, since you finished the book. You mentioned two things. One, the fact that, they had changed several characterizations and glossed over the physics. But two, the fact that you said they had covered pretty much the entirety events of the first book of the trilogy by episode 5, so they had already started to cut into the second book, which is unfortunately a typical thing that you see with streaming services when it comes to book adaptations. They tend to squeeze and compress a lot of elements in one book in order to make room for another one. So my next question for you is, this is a thing that was very heavily criticized when Amazon did this Wheel of Time a couple years ago. How do you think they did it with this one?
So I have no knowledge of the second and third book. I haven't gotten to those yet, but having read just like the synopsis of the second book, it's basically about the wall facer project.
Got it.
So up to episode 5 and its ending, it's basically the first book. Other than the very last scene of the show is also the very last scene in this book. So they've kind of weaved various timelines and whatnot. But I thought it was, the first 5 episodes were very well adapted. They got everything in there that I was really looking for. I enjoyed that they kind of made their own characters, essentially, because we mostly follow just the one guy, and he's kind of split between Augie and Jin.
Okay.
They're from the one character in the book.
Got it.
Of course, you get every once in a while, you'll see, hey, they were in Game of Thrones.
Right.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that was the thing I noticed from the trailer, is the fact that, I'm like, okay, they brought back a couple people from Game of Thrones. You know, like, obviously, the two main cast members are John Bradley, who portrayed Samwell Tarly and portrays the character of Jack in Three Body Problem, and then Liam Cunningham's character, who portrayed Davos Seaworth in Game of Thrones, portrays the character he doesn't really have a rank, but Mr. Wade, who is, like, kind of the head honcho overseeing, you know, all of Earth's efforts in order to deal with the Santee aliens. So I guess going into it, so right, so basically in a basic summarization of it, right, you start off this series with following several different groups of characters, kind of all relating around like physics. There's some sort of government investigation. There's also a flashback to a period of time in China in the late 60s. And basically what it all kind of builds to in the revelation is that there was this alien race known as the Santi, who we made communication with back in the, or rather I should say we as, I don't mean we as Americans, I mean we as a human species, specifically China, made contact with back in the 60s. And now in the modern day, we have basically discovered that the Santi are on their way here, but it's going to take about 400 years to get there. And after attempts at peaceful negotiations with them in an attempt to coexist have kind of fallen through, as well as several efforts being taken to repel their resistance. We basically see our group of characters having to kind of band together in order to begin this effort, in order to ensure the Earth will be ready for this alien invasion when it comes. And it involves a lot of different trippy sci-fi elements. You know, you have physics, you have artificial intelligences, you have Matrix-esque
virtual reality.
Matrix-esque virtual realities. You have you've got a lot of different things that the show is playing with. Like, and there's a lot to break down here. But I guess the thing that immediately grabbed me is the fact of, okay, the things that Benioff and Weiss proved that they were exceptional at with Game of Thrones, what made Game of Thrones so special. Being able to work with a massive, massive stacked ensemble cast. Multiple different storylines that all kind of coalesce into one thing, which again is what Game of Thrones excelled at. I thought that they were exceptionally pretty good at. Also, their ability to sift and blend through different genres I thought was excellent. Again, the usage of sci-fi and the fact that this is basically an alien invasion story, but not told as an alien invasion story. Instead, it's told as like this really interesting character piece where, again, it does what Game of Thrones did so well, which is instead of focusing on the macro, it focuses on the micro through each individual character and their struggle and they're going through, starting off with small minor events that they then build into one that then results in some really honestly tragically gut punch sequences where there are certain sequences that happen early on in the show that I'm like, oh, this is one where they are not fucking around. You know, going back to like certain characters dying very, very quickly, you know, certain sequences where you're like, how is it even possible that they're doing that? Again, the ways that they utilize physics in this, it takes the idea of moral gray characters to the next level. Honestly, I mean, just the writing alone is spectacular. There was a point where I'm like, I thought I was gonna have to take a break, right? I was up until like about 2 o'clock in the morning. I had one episode left to go, and after a while I'm like, you know what, fuck it, I'm just gonna finish it because I'm just so wrapped up and engaged. I just have to see where this is going. Again, I really fell in love with all of these characters. Man, like, again, as somebody who didn't read the book and even is hearing, again, the change that they made, it seems like every change they made was honestly beneficial for the adaptation because, honestly, I think they nailed this one. I really do. Not only is this – right now, this is rivaling Shogun for my favorite show of the year right now, but this is honestly – this might be one of the best things that Netflix has ever done. Like, kudos on them for taking a risk on Benioff and Weiss after the disaster that was that last season of Game of Thrones. My hope is that this show shows that last season was a fluke and that we can blame George R.R. Martin for not finishing the goddamn books in time for when they surpassed it, because holy hell, like this really blew my socks off. This really did.
Yeah, because we forget, like, even with that last season, that they are, when the given to source material to work with, they are, like, yeah, like up there as like the yes, best at what they do.
Yes.
And yeah, like I said, up to episode 5, it's pretty much perfect in terms of story wise and character wise. Like you said, they're expanding everything. They're just creating new characters, and they did that extremely well. After episode 5, I can't speak of how well it's adapted. I have to get to those. But either way, I really enjoyed the last 3 episodes. And it's like a whole, it's very different because they're preparing for an alien invasion that none of them are going to be around for.
Right.
So that's like a whole psychological question of like, why do we care? Why should we even try? And of course, they can't advance science because of the various things that are transpiring. I don't know where exactly the books go. Do we actually get to the invasions? We'll have to get to those. Are you going to read the books now?
Oh, absolutely. It's so funny because I always talk about, if I watch something before I read the book, then I usually don't go back and read the book. There's only two exceptions to that usually. One, when the adaptation I've heard is poor or boring and I've heard that the book that it's based on is better. Like, that's actually exactly what I'm doing with The Wheel of Time right now, where I tried watching The Wheel of Time. I hated the first four episodes. I thought it was so unbelievably boring after the first one, and then I went back and read the book and I'm like, okay, this is already like 1,000 times more interesting. I'm like, it's basically feminist Lord of the Rings, but it's got an interesting spin on it, but I'm still compelled. And this is the other exception, where I'm like, if this show is so effing spectacular and gobsmackingly good and it's got further adaptations that will have yet to be adapted, then I'm like, okay, then I'm going to go back and read the book. Like, that's almost similar to what happened with Golden Compass back when I read that, when that movie came out. But yeah, this was really good. This was really good. I really fell in love with each and every one of these characters and kind of their struggle. And like I said, the struggle, it's a different one. It's an interesting one that I'm not used to seeing. You know, like I said, is how do we prepare for an invasion that won't happen in our lifetimes? You know, it kind of adds new impetus, right, to the idea of being human, where so much of the time, right, the human experience is that the biggest thing that we take into account is the fact that our lives are so minuscule in comparison to the greater macro cosmos of the universe. But what happens when we still have to fight against that macroism, you know, when that actually comes to challenge our minuscule nature? And I think that kind of the balancing act of that does really well, especially given the fact that I think they also do a really interesting thing, which is where the start of this conflict comes from, the fact that, you know, certain human beings make this choice to basically say that, yeah, humanity is no longer capable of looking after ourselves. We need this higher power to almost come in and tell us what to do. You know, you see that. And it's as a result of the things that happened in communist China in the late 60s. So obviously we kind of know where the inspiration for this comes from, right? But rather than this being simply a finger wagging allegory, I like how this ends up kind of expand the idea of this, you know, expands out of it so much more, you know. And even the title, The Three Body Problem, I thought was going to be a lot deeper, but that just kind of ends up being like this explanation of the fact that it's like, yeah, there kind of is no solution to conflict, you know, and how that's like that concept is introduced to us through this like video game-esque thing that two of the characters end up doing in the first couple of episodes. Now, a couple things that I wanted to throw your way. Did you have a favorite character? Who did you think was the most compelling, and what are the major changes that they made with some of the characters from the books? I know a big thing that my friend from school was not happy about was how they whitewashed one of the characters, one of the main five younger characters, right? Because it centers around, because the main characters, right, I guess I should break this down. So you have five main characters who all worked under this one physicist whose death by suicide in the beginning is kind of one of the inciting incidents for this. You have this private investigator who's investigating some of the events portrayed by Benedict Wong. You have his superior who ends up like kind of becoming the leader of the coalition efforts against Earth, that being the Liam Cunningham character. You've got obviously the two characters that are kind of in direct communication with the aliens, who are known as the Shanti. What's it called? You know, Jonathan Pryce's character, and I forget the older Asian woman's character, who is the mother of the character who kills herself in the beginning.
Ye Wenji.
Yes, exactly. And then you have, I think that's pretty much it for the main human characters, right? And I believe it was the John Bradley character, the Jack character, that they changed a bit from the book. I believe he was Asian originally, and then they recast him, or maybe I'm getting that wrong.
So in the book, we mostly follow the one guy called Wang Miao, and he's split between Aza Gonzalez and I don't have her name, but she plays
Jess Hong is the actress's name.
She's kind of the main character in the whole thing. Yeah. I guess Liam Cunningham's character Wade, I guess he's maybe taken from like a general kind of character, but he's definitely more prominent here, and I would say he's my favorite character because Liam Cunningham is just
Liam Cunningham,
on all cylinders.
He never disappoints. It's funny because as iconic a character as Davos Seaworth was on Game of Thrones, people would be remiss to remember that he wasn't introduced until the second season. And even then, like, it really took him a couple seasons before he like really became like a major player, because he doesn't end up like meeting Jon Snow until the end of the fourth season, and he doesn't end up like being like becoming like John's new number two until like season six, after the death of Stannis Baratheon in season five. It's so crazy to me, because we recapped all this in our Talking Thrones recap that Professor Pat and I did 2 years ago now when that ended. But like, man, Liam Cunningham, he never misses. He never, ever misses. And I like the other Game of Thrones inserts that we got. Like, we got Conleth Hill, a.k.a. Varys, as a quick insert as well. There were a couple of other Game of Thrones. Jonathan Pryce, obviously, is the High Sparrow. So there were a couple Game of Thrones alumni that popped up here and there. So I was happy that they were still paying it forward. You know, and like I said, it's just the rest of the cast as well. Hovind Adepo, Issa Gonzalez, Benedict Wong, obviously, who's been making his rounds recently. Like I said, there were a couple of other performers that I thought were interesting, though, too. Namely, so it's two characters. One, the actress who plays the kind of, what's it called? The stand-in for the Santi, the AI, which is basically like the embodiment of this supercomputer that they've essentially created and sent to Earth as a kind of like a harbinger for their arrival. What is it? The Sophon, I think, is what they call it.
Yeah, that's what they call it.
Right.
It's a proton that they unfolded in like 11 dimensions or whatever. Right. It's very high concept.
Right. Very sci-fi. High concept.
Right. In the book, they like go on for pages about it. I just love it. It's very theoretical, but it's cool. So who cares? Yeah.
That actress, and then the actress who played Tatiana, who is like another one of the followers of the Santi, but is like kind of a little bit too eager, let's say, to serve her new alien overlords. I mean, that character just admitted that from the minute that she was introduced to the Issa Gonzalez character, and I'm like, what the hell is up with her? And she basically like becomes essentially like their private assassin, you know, because there's a point where the Santi stop communicating with their human allies, and then they reach out to them again at the end of the series. And oh man, like, so I just wanted your thoughts on those two characters, right? The Tatiana character, like, does she have that big of a part in the book, or no? They kind of like embellish on her character a little bit for the show.
I don't think there is a character like her in the book. That's like a mostly a show invention, which I thought was pretty cool. It's like, yeah, you have this, like, I guess it touches on something with like the whole organization that embraced the Santi. They're actually called Tri-Solarians in the book, but I get the change. It's shorter. Yeah. It's easier to remember. So that was a cool angle of it. It's kind of like a religious thing. Like he talks to the Mike Evans character. He talks to the Santi like as my lord. So like they're like these godly beings. That was definitely a cool angle that they went with.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because I feel that's another thing that Hollywood has been trying to crack for years now, which is kind of the mixing and meshing between how to mix science and religion. And I actually thought that was pretty cool, which is where they essentially were like, yeah, religion, but with a scientific explanation behind it. And I'm like, wow, that's actually kind of ingenious. And I do also like how they broke down like the main differences between humans and the Santi, which is where it's like, oh, the Santi, they have all this advanced technology, but it takes them a lot longer to figure it out. Like human beings, like the one advantage that we have, it's even though they kind of like are aware of everything that we've got going on to the point where they don't know what we're thinking. And so we can kind of like throw them off with like random probabilities. And if we pull our efforts, we can advance our stuff way faster than they can, which is why they kind of like operate through like, in a weird way, it's funny because they don't have the ability to, it's established pretty early on that they don't have the ability to lie, but as a result of our advanced technology, if we pool our efforts, you know, they can like, so the only thing they can throw at us is by like crippling our technology by spreading fear and misinformation, also having a lot of like real world implications as well, if you will. But I thought that the kind of breaking down the differences between the two of them was pretty interesting. Now, there is one character that I did want to talk about, and I'll be interested to see how they, right? So we talked about the five main characters that they kind of broke down, right? You have Jin, you have Augie, you have Saul, Hovind Adepo's character, you have Jack, John Bradley's character, and you have the character of Will, portrayed by Alex Sharp, who is an actor that has kind of been making the rounds. He's been in a couple things here and there. Ironically enough, this is not the first sci-fi alien invasion-esque thing that I've seen him in. He was in this movie that I'm pretty sure I'm the only person that saw this movie back when it came out in 2019. It was this Rupert Wyatt alien invasion movie with John Goodman that was called Captive State. It was actually one of the first things that I saw Jonathan Majors in. I saw it back, I believe it came out in April of 2019. I was the only one that saw it. In a weird way, it was kind of similar to this, where it's like we are in communication with our alien overlords who basically like have us in essentially this like concentration camp-esque totalitarian government. And obviously, you know, there's this human underground resistance that's trying to fight them off and go against them. And I was quite interested to see kind of what the similarities between the two of them were. And Alex Sharp was in that one as well. And in this one, he is a character that is kind of friends with the main group, but unfortunately receives a pretty depressing cancer diagnosis. And we're following this character throughout the event and throughout the events of the show, as like the rest of the characters kind of get involved with the government, trying to, you know, figure out how to, you know, first figure out like that the Shanti are real, then figure out how to like fight against them. You're kind of just following this one character who's kind of just like slowly dying from cancer and trying to like enjoy his last days. And you're kind of wondering throughout, you're like, okay, where is this going? Where is this plot line storyline going? And where they go with it. I mean, Benioff and Weiss are no strangers to making us fall in love with the character and then absolutely ripping our heart out and crushing it in front of our eyes as they give that character one of the most tragic send-offs ever. But goddamn, they might have taken the cake here with how they sent off that character. Because, I mean, did you want to break down exactly how they end up resolving this Will character, or should I take this? Because, oh man.
We can do a co-effort. Similar to you, throughout the show, I was like, okay, why is this guy here? What is he really adding to the plot? And eventually, it just kind of clicks. I'm like, okay, I'm back in. And I'm guessing this is something taken from the next book. It feels like a very sci-fi book idea, the way they want to propel this probe to however fast they want to go. And... okay, I'll let you take over now, because it's a very bizarre
idea. It's bizarre, but it's also so tragic. And again, this is I love them because it's still awesome to see that, like, okay, even in the age where we are inundated, like, that they can still do some cool shit, which is where you essentially have this character who's dying of cancer, but who also happens to be like a super genius when it comes to, you know, physics and everything, right? So their whole idea is, it's like, okay, in terms of trying to learn more about the Shanti, they are going to essentially fire a probe containing a person to essentially be intercepted by the Shanti so they can be experimented on and at the same time, you know, learn more. And I think it's this co-attempt at a peace offering while at the same time being a means of like infiltration and figuring out more about them. One problem: the Shanti are still 400 years away, and they have to figure out how to send someone at light speed in a manner in which they won't die, because obviously even if they can crack that, it's 200 light years. So like, okay, how do we come up with all of this? You know, they managed to figure out the process of getting the probe there, you know, by using a combination of solar sails, which that was a pretty good throwback to Attack of the Clones right there. Solar sails and using nuclear bombs in order to propel the rocket forward. So like, it definitely does have its, which I thought was a pretty cool reference to the core. So it definitely does have its trappings in terms of, and its references in terms
shout
of-
Shout out like, to the core. Good
shout
movie.
Out to the core. One of the best all-time bad sci-fi movies. I love that movie. But anyways, so you've got that, but they obviously have the problem of, it's like, okay, so they also introduced that they've perfected cryosleep, but they're like, okay, but at the end of the day, whoever is going to go through this, it's still going to take like at least between 150 and 200 years to get to this alien fleet. So how do we do this? So this, essentially what they decide to do is, they're like, okay, we're going to take this guy who's dying of cancer anyway. They've already said they operated on all the tumors, but the cancer spread too far. Like, he is dying. We are going to essentially take this dying person, this Will character's brain. We're going to cut it out of his body. We're going to put it into cryosleep, into cryofreeze, so that it's not technically dead, but it is in a state of suspended animation. And we're going to fire it into space and have the aliens potentially
catch it
and reconstruct the body. So that premise alone, I was already like, and how they pull it off, it's so genius, because that's a pretty preposterous explanation. That's some fucking like that's some like B-tier like sci-fi thing where it's like you essentially tear that's some Tammy and the T-Rex shit right there. But they have it be so gut-wrenchingly awful and heartbreaking, because you see the other characters who are like lifelong friends with this guy, and you have him like say goodbye to his friends like at least 15 times over. His friends are trying to talk him out of it. He's in love with the one with the main character, who is telling him don't do this, but he's like, I'm dying anyways. Like, what do I have to lose? And oh, and as if that wasn't tragic enough, so they go through with the process, right? I'm not even done yet. That's not even the tip of the iceberg. They take this poor bastard's brain out. They put it in this rocket ship. They fire it off, right? They also have this moment where they essentially, where at the end of like episode 5 or 6, they reveal that they are, that they covered the entire planet with using the Sophon and like this under the dome S covering thing. So I was already worried that I'm like, okay, the rocket's not even going to make it out of the atmosphere. But also remember that again, this is not going with typical sci-fi traffic.
It can change. It can be big. It can be microscopic. Right.
But at the same time, I was also like, okay, there's no way this is going to work. Something's going to go wrong here. And it did. And it was still so gut-wrenching in the worst way possible, where they're using the nuclear bombs. It's working. They're sending the probe off. It's firing at light speed. And it was some shit right out of For All Mankind. One of the tethers between the solar sail and the rocket ship snaps, and it just goes hurtling off into space. And I'm like,
well, now what?
Now what? But also, I'm gutted, because I'm like, you already tore our hearts out by having this dude. Like one of these guys is already dead. The other three have already kind of separated over this issue because, like I said, because of the political leanings, you know, one of them is kind of spearheading the project. One of them kind of wants nothing to do with it, but has been like recruited as one of the like foreheaders of this secret resistance project that humanity is doing. And one of them just wants nothing to do with the government and is now basically taking all of her scientific resources and giving them to all of the poor and impoverished. But so, yeah, like I said, it is the way that this resolved. It didn't resolve entirely on a cliffhanger, but it is setting it up for a couple of other seasons renewals. And I mean, oh, man, like I said, they threw a lot at us in 8 episodes. But unlike Avatar The Last Airbender, which was based off something that was already pretty perfect, and it felt like they were just like trying to improve on it and make changes that didn't need to be made. This one, it's like, man, I want more of this. This is, I really, really loved it. This is easily in my top 5 favorite shows of 2024. And I'm very, very excited to see. And hopefully, I'm very hopeful that Netflix will renew this for another 2 seasons so that they can finish out the book series. Because, man, like this was damn good stuff. This was damn good stuff.
Yeah, because I don't know how many people are watching it. Like, I tried to spread out my story. Like, hey, guys, if you want some more sci-fi, take a look at this. But it's not really making the rounds as like your typical viral Netflix show, but hopefully there's enough there and that the D&D can lobby Netflix to keep this going.
Because that's the other thing too, also, is it's like, as far as the marketing, we know that how Netflix does with its marketing, but like, these are the guys who made Game of Thrones, the biggest fucking show for a decade, you know? And I think that where they screwed up, again, it was the last season, because now, because of everything that they did in the last season, HBO was kind of able to pivot and be like, oh, no, this is George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones. Benioff and Weiss are the bad guys who screwed it up, you know, especially now that they've got House of the Dragon and everything. So I don't know how tied to it Benioff and Weiss want the kind of the baggage from Game of Thrones following them around with the show. But unfortunately, I think that might have been a hindrance, because, I mean, you've got a sci-fi show based off of hit book series that is finished, that is compelling and interesting and different from the creators of Game of Thrones. Why would you not market that more? You know, there's going to be a bunch of people that are interested. House of the Dragon proved that Game of Thrones fervor did not go away, you know? So I don't know. I just thought that was interesting, to say the least. But like I said, so obviously, like I said, you have not read the next 2 books, so I won't ask about any predictions as far as what's going to come. But like I said, if the ending of this season is anything to prove, it's that I'm very, very interested to see where this show was going to go. This was a spectacular 8-episode watch. I'm really, really glad I binged this all in a day. This, for me, is easily one of my top 5 favorite shows of the year. I don't know how many times I'm going to say this enough. This is one of the shows that I'm going to be recommending to people to watch, definitely, for the remainder of the year. 3 Body Problem, I'm saying it right now, 5 stars. 5 out of 5 stars.
Oh, 5 stars.
Holy yes, ooh. Yes, I'm going that far. This show, again, it threw me for a loop. It went in so many different directions that I wasn't expecting. It kept me gripped. It kept me on my toes the entire time. All the characters, even if the acting wasn't the best, the writing for them was all solid. And again, just as far as like having a complete full gamut 360 degree story, this is as good as it gets for me. 5 stars.
Yeah, so the book was 4.5 stars for me, and I think I'm gonna go the same for the show. If not for one thing, the one scene that they like absolutely smashed it out of the park was the boat scene. Like in the book,
which we didn't even talk about, but oh well, man,
I think we should touch on it. In the book, it's kind of like he says like the whole hose thing, like the hose stops working, and then poof, the guy just like falls. Oh my
god! And like,
But here, it's like a horror sequence.
It really is. And the fact that it starts off as slow as it does, and it's like, why aren't the fibers working? It's like, they are. Just give it a minute. And then you see the hose slide, and like, oh my God, it was just wowzers. I don't think I've that, for that sequence alone, I'm like, I don't think I've ever seen a sequence quite like that. But probably the closest that I saw was in the first Resident Evil movie, but it was like super corny and dumb, you know? And like, we only ever seen it happen with one person. We've never seen it happen with like an entire ship full of people. And I was just like, fuck me. Oh man. Like, oh man.
I think the most like effective part of it was like when you're moving and it's like the cutout of like the paper people, just like the legs start falling off. Just, like,
yeah.
This invisible thing is coming and everything just getting destroyed.
It was so good. It was so good. It was so good. Oh man. People, go watch Three Body Problem if you get a chance. Please do. You will not regret it. One of the few Netflix things that is actually good. Like I said, I mean, Netflix has these once a month kind of event things, and they kind of end up being pretty awesome. Like, they had The Gentleman a couple weeks ago. I still have yet to finish that, but that's also way better than I thought it was going to be. Like, Netflix may have actually finally been listening to some of our critiques and complaints, and the stuff they're doing is it's pretty good. It's pretty fucking good. You know, they've got that Chaos show with Jeff Goldblum coming out soon. They've got Arcane finally coming back this year. I mean,
you got Squid Game coming.
We got
back.
Squid Game season 2. And I still don't know how I feel about that, but yeah, they've got some good stuff. You know, I know some of the new stuff as well. You know, Eric, Carry On, Black Doves. They've got some good stuff coming out, to say the least. So color me impressed with this one, Netflix. I didn't think you had this one in you, you know. And that's not even getting into some of their legacy shows that they're wrapping up this, you know, Cobra Kai is wrapping up this year. Stranger Things is Cobra Kai and Umbrella Academy are wrapping up this year. Stranger Things is wrapping up next year. So a lot of their legacy shows are coming to an end. So they need some new shows in order to pick up the slack. So yeah, they might want to
continue with the show.
They really
get a few more seasons out.
Get a few more seasons out. Get a couple more things going for this. But yeah,
I don't know if the books go there, but I'm guessing we will go to the 400 years. If we get there.
It definitely should. Yeah, definitely. So with that being said, Luke. So Roadhouse, Three Body Problem. It's been a good weekend for streaming. I'm just gonna wrap it up with this. So I saw this horror movie yesterday. It's from Neon. It's from this director named Michael Mohan, I believe is his name. It stars Sydney Sweeney. It's called Immaculate. The basic premise is essentially Get Out, but with Italian nuns, where essentially Sydney Sweeney is this, you know, girl from Midwestern USA who goes to this mysterious Italian convent, where some sinister things are happening. And magically about 20 minutes in, she ends up pregnant. And I'm like, okay, some fuck shit is going on here, because there's no way that she became immaculately conceived. I'm like, there's no way. And I mean, the twists and turns where this movie goes, it's pretty mad science-y. And I will say, it's not exactly difficult to figure out where it goes. Like I said, it's more so in like the horror elements of it. And the fact that, like I said, if you've seen Get Out, you pretty much understand exactly where this is going to go. But what I will say, the actual ending sequence of this, like, if you're going to watch this movie for any reason, the ending sequence alone, after everything is wrapped up and resolved, after she's escaped and everything, when she actually, you know, since she is pregnant for a majority of the movie, you know, she does end up giving birth at the end.
Ooh.
And what I will say, so if anybody has seen the horror movie Malignant and understands the twist of that movie's kind of just okay. But the twist alone is one of the all-time great horror movie twists. One of the all-time great ones. And I will say, not necessarily the twist, because I would say the twist is pretty easy to figure out. The actual ending sequence of this movie, the last like 5 minutes, I would say, all-timer, just to see it in a theater, all-timer horror movie ending. That's all I'm going to say. Like,
check it out before Godzilla X Kong or something.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I would heavily, heavily recommend watching this. Like I said, I was just enamored by it, to say the least. And it was my jaw was on the floor. Like I said, it's a horror movie and it knows its trappings, but it's well made. It's fun enough. Sydney Sweeney's not the worst thing, and the supporting cast is interesting enough. Like I said, everybody who's involved knows exactly what kind of a movie they're making. And there's this one, I'm going to call him Mad Scientist Priest, who is just, ugh. It's everything that I wanted from that horrible movie that came out with Alana Glazer and Justin Theroux and Pierce Brosnan that A24 did. a couple of years ago, the name of which is currently escaping me because it is still one of the worst movies that I've ever seen. But it's that done right, essentially, is what I will say. So, immaculate. That's my five-second review on it. And I didn't get a chance to watch X-Men 97 this past weekend because I was going to. And then I'm like, you know what? I could watch this new X-Men show that requires like having watched like four seasons of nostalgia that I don't have because I was not alive for a majority of the 90s. But you know what I can do? I can go back and rewatch X-Men Evolution, which is the X-Men show that I grew up with, which is still solid and still holds up and is still great. So that's it.
I really enjoyed X-Men 97. I've never seen an episode of the original, but still just seeing like an X-Men thing again after like however long it's been.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we've had an X-Men thing. I know we've got Deadpool and Wolverine coming out later this year, but like we've been overdue for some X-Men content, to say like, the least, for a couple years
now. They need these guys in the MCU. Like Secret Wars over with, get the full roster in there.
Yeah, we need the X-Men back. We really need the X-Men back. So like I said, with that being said, Luke, thank you for joining me once again. We had a lot of content to cover, but we did it with grace. And I will see you next weekend for Big Monkey and Giant Lizard back at it again.
Yes, I'll be honest. It's the clips are winning me over. Like Kong making emotions like
they know.
I'm leaning. Like, I'm leaning into it
because you know what they're doing with this movie. They're finally listening to the critiques and be like, okay, we understand. We're not going to be able to create like compelling human character in this, so we're just going to make this about the monsters. We're not really incorporating the humans in any way, shape, or form. There's no Millie Bobby Brown in this one. There's no Alexander Skarsgård. It's just Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry. We got Dan Stevens doing a cool accent. And that's the other thing too, is that this year is the return of Dan Stevens as well, between this movie, Cuckoo, and Abigail. Like, finally, long past time that he came back. But yeah, like I said, the fact that it's mostly just going to be Godzilla and Kong and a bunch of other bad titans, it's going to be awesome. I can't wait for this movie. So where can the good people follow you on the interwebs?
They can follow me at Luke Reviews on YouTube, although I'm not much time for that, but hopefully there's still something in the locker waiting, or on Instagram or on Letterboxd, Luke Reviews.
Yes, and of course you can follow me with everything going on at Movie Nerd Reviews across all platforms, at Official Talking TV Podcast across all platforms. Be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube. Follow us if you're on Twitch. This episode will be available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts tomorrow. And as always, people, 12 seasons in a short film, and watch more fucking movies. We'll see you guys next week for Godzilla and Kong.